Hey everybody, it's Greg McKenzie, your Missiology podcast producer, and of course one of the disembodied voices on the post-game discussion episodes. So we're back. Missiology podcast season 2 is here. We're so excited. This season we're focusing on some luminaries who are nearing the end of their careers in missiology. We got multiple interviews already in the can, so production is underway, things are happening, and I want to give all of you the chance. Maybe you were wondering after such a long hiatus, is Missiology Podcast done? I tell you no, we are undefeated, but we need your help. If you love what we're doing, if you want to see it continue, please consider supporting us. Head over to patreon.com/missiology. You can be a monthly supporter, you can give a one-time donation, whatever you can do to express your appreciation for our exploration of missiology. That is a huge help. We need your support. We need that love. Please like and share on whatever streaming service you're using. That's a huge help. iTunes reviews make a big difference. Whatever you can do to get the word out, we're grateful. Okay, let's do this. Season 2, Episode 1 with Chuck and Meg Kraft.
So I'm sitting here right now with Dr. Kraft and Dr. Kraft.
Yes.
And thank you so much, Meg and Chuck, for having me in your home, for being a part of this podcast. This is Missiology Podcast, and we are interviewing you about your experiences as a couple, and Dr. Kraft, you in your many years of experience teaching missiology. Thank you for being a part of this podcast. On behalf of all of our listeners, thank you. My first question is going to be about a primary experience that shaped your missiology. Tell me about a high point, perhaps as a practitioner or a scholar and a scholar in the field of missiology, when you felt engaged and motivated, an experience that shaped your missiology. Tell me what happened, who was involved, what did you do?
Well, I never planned to be a missiologist. We planned to be field missionaries and went to Nigeria expecting to spend the rest of our lives there. But God intervened with a different plan. So we did have our field experience, but then through a series of things, we went back to, or came to Fuller in the School of World Mission as professors. I was a professor, my wife was raising the family, and then she had got her own stint as a professor at Biola University. I think the crucial thing, so much of academics is theoretical without very much practical experience. And we were out in the bush for 3 years of practice, and fed that into who I was. I was an anthropologist by that time. I went to Wheaton College, and with the expectation of preparing for the mission field. And when somebody when I asked people what should a prospective missionary major in, and somebody said anthropologist, anthropology, and I said, what's that? And they said, well, that's the only subject in the curriculum that deals with non-Western peoples. I said, well, that's good enough for me. So I did my degree in anthropology, then went on to seminary in Ashland, Ohio, and out to Nigeria. What that all was, that informed my practice. For example, I refused to preach or to do things that people can do for themselves. They thought that was a little strange, but
we had believers. There were a few people who had found the Lord through the leprosarium that the mission ran. So there were some believers there,
right.
And they had witnessed, and other people were following Christ too. So with that in mind, it was easy for them to do the teaching and the preaching.
Yeah, they told us there were five or six small churches in our area. We didn't find all of them. But anyway, when we left 3 years later, there were over 20. And these were self-governing bodies because I refused to do stuff. They asked me how many times I wanted to preach each month. I said none. Then they said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, what do you need? And they hadn't been asked that question before. They said, the missionary does it all. I said, well, this one isn't going to. I said, what would you like to have done? They said, we want Bible study. So I said, when do I come to your house? They said, oh, you don't come to our house. We don't even have chairs to sit on. I said, where do you sit? They sit on the mat. I said, well, that's where I'll sit too. And then we'd read a passage and they say, what does it mean? I said, I don't know. They said, you don't know? Have you ever studied? Oh, I've studied this a lot. I know what it means to me. I just don't know what it's going to mean to you. They said, well, what's that got to do with it? Missionary always tells us what it means. I said, well, this one's not going to. So they learned how to be on their own from the very beginning, which caused a problem with the mission leaders, because the mission leaders were used to being in charge, and I saw myself more as a coach than as somebody directing and in charge. But the church grew, and we were very, very happy. And in the process, we developed something that I call, what do I call it? Culture positive, that's what it is.
Culture affirming. Yeah.
Culture affirming, culture positive. And we did everything, whatever we could to make sure that it was their setup.
I had had my training in education, but I was very excited to be going to Africa. That's what he had been called to when he was 16, I think. And so he was headed for Africa. He says, if you want to marry me, you're going to Africa. And so I said, fine. But I think my motivation for missiology and really getting into helping others be able to understand better what missions was all about when we tried to take the gospel to a different culture came when we got to Nigeria. I could see how very different the women, most of them had never gone to school. They didn't read. They didn't write. And yet they were happy and contented and anxious to be good wives and good mothers and so forth. And so I realized there was a big gap. And for me to be able to sit next to and listen and learn and communicate effectively, I could see it was a real job that we weren't very well prepared for, unless you do understand the cultural differences or want to understand the cultural differences.
The mission leaders were not very highly schooled. The most was fourth grade, for most of them.
The locals.
The locals, yeah. Mm-hmm. But schooling is different from education. They were not highly schooled, but they were educated.
Yeah.
And they learned to be on their own, which was a threat to the missionaries, because mm-hmm. they didn't just say yes when. Things came up,
yeah.
And that caused a problem for us too, and we were not allowed to go back by the missionaries, and I think it was because we were affirming their culture rather than either consciously or unconsciously making Westerners out of them.
Wow.
I wrote an article on two conversions, conversion to Christ, conversion to a new culture, and we were against that new culture conversion. So that's sort of our story in brief,
yeah.
Brief form.
Thank you.
But we loved those people, and they weren't happy that we had to stay home.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you have to stay home from practice, that's when you become a missiologist.
That's right.
I'm sure he wouldn't have been able to get so much writing done if we'd been on the field.
Yeah.
Right.
And both of us, I had opportunity to teach after getting my degree at Fuller. I was able to teach at Biola University in their School of Intercultural Studies. And both of us were able to use that experience and all the Lord had prepared us for teaching others that are going to be out, going out and working cross-culturally like we did.
Yeah. I'm curious, as you think about that time that you spent in Nigeria, are there specific people that stand out or interactions that just stick in your memory as, this was an important interaction, I remember this day when this thing happened? Are there any stories like that that really became the story that you went back to again and again in your imagination as you're developing your missiology, you're teaching your classes? Can you think of one of those interactions that you had?
Oh, just a flood of them, actually. We had I had five disciples, five guys that stuck with me, and we went out and visited villages and did pioneer missionary stuff. We were out in the bush. We were not so knowledgeable when you get to urban situations. One thing I think of is the church leaders, my guys and others. When it got to be New Year's Eve, we went out and sang and danced at various places, and it got to be like 1 o'clock in the morning and all. And I said to the guys, "We're going to wake them up. They're going to be angry." I said, "No," I says, "they'll be angry if we don't wake them up."
And I felt left out because it was only men who could go around and sing and dance, and the wives were supposed to stay home with the children. So I felt sort of cheated on that experience. But again, I had to realize that I was playing the role of a woman in their society, right? So,
well, they asked me, "Can we dance?" And I said, "Why not? But you're gonna run it. Is there anything in the local dances that?" That we ought to be careful about, that we shouldn't get into." He said, "Oh yeah, we want to organize Christian dances, and if anybody wants to sell cigarettes, we're not going to allow that. If they want to, go off in the bushes and make love or whatever, we're not going to do that." These were their decisions.
They
said, I said, "What about, is there anything else that you don't want to have done?" And they made a kind of a list, and they said, "There's a drum beat that we won't allow." And I said, "Really? To me, a drum beat's a drum beat's a drum beat, you know." But, "Oh no, if this beat comes on, this is immoral." Okay, but they made a decision, and they saw some things that needed to be keep away from or be careful about. And the missionary didn't know to ask those questions, and so they ran it their own way, and sometimes they danced nearly all night.
It was exciting to hear them dance the songs we sang at church, and people who would hear the singing and dancing from other places would come by and join in the dance. And we found that one up on the mountain right behind us, when we finally got some of the local evangelists and Chuck to go up there, they mentioned the name Jesus, and the chief said, "Who is this Jesus? Our girls have been singing about him." They learned those songs as they danced and sang them up in their village. And so that was a good communication tool that no book had ever told us about. It was a matter of experiencing and learning.
The songs preceded the speaking. So, you know, we've got experiences like that constantly. They would ask us for advice, and we say, "What do you think? What does you're accountable to the Holy Spirit, not to us."
And they stick with the rules after we go home, so they need to help form them, whatever the Holy Spirit helps them decide should be the activities and rules of the church.
Yeah, I said, suppose I, the missionary, institute something the church has to do. We go home as missionaries, and there's nobody left there to enforce the rules that the missionaries have set up. They said, "Well, we can't change it." I said, "Why not?" "Because, well, you're the missionary, so we'll keep doing it even though we know it's a mistake." I said, well, what if you institute something yourself and we go home and do you realize that it's a mistake? What do we do? He said, oh, we change it. You mean you'll change it? Why wouldn't you change it if the other way, it was the other way around? Oh, we couldn't do that because we out of honor to the missionaries, which was a mistake. I mean, they were not understanding the missionaries as they should have. They should have recognized that even the missionaries are willing to.
And they would look for a biblical base too for their own beliefs. So that was good. Yeah. So,
sometimes they say you have a different Bible than we have. Say, really? Yeah. And the big issue in our day was polygamy. And the missionaries never understood polygamy as, I mean, they understood missionaries and interpreted them as being about sex. We lived in a village for a few days, and the guy that was in charge of the village, he said, you missionaries are lucky. You white people are lucky. I said, really? I said, yeah, you've only got one wife.
That's insightful.
He said, he said, you'll notice that we come home, we sometimes don't come home at night. And I said, well, why is that? He said, well, we're tired out. You have to sleep with one wife one night, and the other one the next night, the other one back and forth. We can't handle that. So we don't come home. Yeah, see, polygamy was social security for the women. None of the women were unmarried. They all got married, even ones that looked the worst at all. But the mission was dead set against it, and anybody to be a leader in the mission had to give up any extra wives. And we had a situation where a person, a guy that aspired to leadership, had to have more than one wife. That was one of the qualifications.
But the mission didn't allow that, so we stood for what? I mean, we had to back the mission.
We couldn't have any leaders.
What? Go ahead.
We couldn't have any leaders in the church, guys.
Wow.
Because they're traditional leaders, and they had more than one wife.
I was going to say that it did limit our leadership, but when he found some older person who believed in Jesus, he could baptize him. But he said after he baptized the baptizable ones, he had them come and stand and committed them all to the Lord. And he said the Lord would accept him. Mm-hmm. He just could never be a leader in the church,
right.
But he could be a Christian in God's eyes.
But they told me, he says, you won't be back. Said nobody we like ever comes back.
We said no, we're coming back, but we used the drum in the church, and none of the other churches used the drum at that time. And so we were, and the music, they said, can you translate some songs for us in our language? And we said, don't you have music? And they said, well, yes, they had, they hoed in the fields with music, and they had music that they sang when they did their dances and all of the after market day. And we said, why don't you praise God with your music and make your own music?
Yeah.
And it was so exciting because then they could be praising God about their own experiences and not from the stuff in the Western world. But no other church in the denominational mission area there had their own music. And so there again, we were kind of breaking the rules to use the drum in the church. And to call people to come to church, we used the drum. And I guess we never did what, they would sing, they would take the songs. When the witch doctor's wife died, they went down and sang the Christian songs for him.
The headmaster of the school took about, I think it was 80 or 90 kids to the funeral. And the guy whose wife had died was supposed to stay in seclusion in a hut during these the dances and mourning and stuff. He came out from the hut and said to the thing, he said, we never knew you Christians cared.
So we learned a lot.
He started coming to church, but he stopped coming to church.
After.
And I don't know for sure, but I think what the guy was saying was, you people love us enough, but there's no power in the church. This guy could say, when I need power, I go to the medicine man. That's where the power is. I don't go to the Christians. And then years later, when we had a kind of my wife and I had a conversion to what we now call power ministry, it was with that vision. Here's a guy saying, Jesus is important, but there's no power there. Mm-hmm. And power was the primary thing that they're...
That's why I'm convinced that we need to, when we send people out, have them learn where they're getting their power at the first place and what they need power for, so that they can then see how God can provide that power for them, because he's able. I was speaking to a group of women one time on the island of Chuuk-Truk in Micronesia, and we were teaching them on spiritual warfare and spiritual power. And I asked them if they ever went to the local practitioners, and these were all pastors' wives. And they says, oh yes, they said, we need an answer. That's where we go, because they give us a quick answer. Yeah. They have answers. Yeah. And the church, they've been told, they had the church there for 100 years, and they've been told by the leaders that they'd pray for them, but they never followed up on it. You know, we're always, we don't expect God to answer our prayers immediately. And so they don't get the answers they need from the church. And so we have to learn how they look for power and how they need power in order to face daily life, spiritual power. And we don't feel like we need that in America, because everybody does their own thing and we feel like we're in control. We don't recognize the need for spiritual power to exist every day.
Yeah. Our Christianity is knowledge-based rather than power-based. And they're dealing with the with everything. They're power-based rather than knowledge-based. Yeah. So when we get to, you know, when we get to talking about what does missiology need, that's the thing that
would be a big one. So let's go to the next question then. Okay. And if we want to, we can come back to some other high points. Your answers have been incredibly helpful. This is fantastic. You're telling exactly the kind of stories that we want to hear.
Yeah.
So this is fantastic. So if you think of another story like that, you say, oh, we can go back to question one, no problem.
Well, I should say one thing.
Yeah.
Like I said, we don't know, haven't experienced much of urban Christianity. Urban Christianity. So, you know, there's a temptation in urban mission for people to deal with the pretty much Western things, kind of thing, at a knowledge level. And the missionaries coming from outside, not understanding that this is what's the undercurrent of their approach to life in general, they may miss the power stuff. The missionaries may miss the power stuff, but it's there, and it's still the most important thing for most people.
That's right.
And when we see churches in other lands, we've been in Thailand many times. Doing some teaching and all there, but I did research for my PhD there. And you realize that even though people look Westernized and are working in offices and so forth, they still have this need for having spiritual power to be successful, to be safe. When they take their trips, they have to have an image of Buddha or something on them, some kind of a form that keeps them safe from all the powers they face. And we don't even think about that. When we see them dressed like us, we think they look at the world like us, and it's not true. And so when you're working in a place like that, you do need to take time to see where they're going for their power, and then be sure the church is zeroing in on other ways of getting the power, because God will give us the protection. He'll give us what we need. But we just don't feel we need it in our country, as basically, because we don't understand spiritual power very well. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid what we've brought them is powerless Christianity. Mm-hmm. I did.
So it's been a privilege to be able to share with others and to get others to help see that there is a spiritual realm and that Satan is active, and we need to let God have control and meet, you know, power encounters, so that that there can be heartfelt commitment, because we think of somebody like we had always thought that if somebody they slip up on their faith, you know, they backslid if they went to a diviner. Well, hey, they went to a diviner because the church wasn't doing anything to give them answers. And so, you know, we're at fault for driving them or allowing them to keep going to their practitioners that they always go to. And telling them not to doesn't answer the problem.
Right.
We have to give them a substitute. And God is able.
So if you ask us what is there anything missing in missiology, we'd point to power. Mm-hmm. And dealing with spirits and things like fetishes and idols and things like that that are very real in the Christianity that's been brought to them. So I've been writing on powerless Christianity.
So maybe this second question will get at that some more, perhaps. Because the second question is about how you've been influenced by other missiologists, other practitioners. Name one or two primary books or conversations or friendships that have contributed to your research, to your ministry. What was the content of those conversations, and why did they make a difference for you?
Well, when, like I mentioned, I was the fourth member of the faculty here, and so I got to introduce my hero, which was Eugene Nida, to missiology, and on the one hand, and then McGavran and Tippett on the other. What was here at Fuller when we came was McGavran and Tippett and church growth stuff, which is very valid, but didn't cover all the bases as far as I was concerned. And so I was able to introduce anthropology. I guess I'd call it communicational anthropology more, because communication and anthropology kind of wed together to bring that stream into missiology to join with the church growth missiology. I guess I've forgotten what your question is.
So is there a conversation, a book perhaps that you read, a person that was really significant that shaped your missiology? I'm especially interested if you can recall, you know, there's that one conversation that I had with Eugene or with Tippett, you know, and I remember he said this or she said this, and there was this
yeah.
that shaped me.
No, I don't think I would point to any one kind of thing. I didn't know Tippett when I came on this faculty, but learned to respect him. He was probably he was probably the deepest and broadest missiologists, and he was deeply immersed in anthropology and applying anthropology to mission. And then on the other side, Nida was. He was with the American Bible Society, but his big concern was he was translation secretary. So, but his big concern was getting missionaries to find and deal with cultural things, and culture. I'll say culture and communication, these two things. And I think I was able to add to the perspective here in the training here to the communication and I guess I would call it practical anthropology, which was the term of the journal that shaped us a lot. Yeah, you say any one conversation. Well, no, there are many conversations, and that little journal came out every 2 months. Presented and really hammered the cultural the need for cultural understanding and working in what I'd call culture positive ways. Bill Smalley got to be the editor of the well, that journal was started by Wheaton professor Bob Taylor, and then taken over after a few years when Taylor got sick. by the Bible Society, and became a catalyst for a lot of change that we weren't the only ones, but we were part of it. So not a single person, but a whole bunch of things. And then we, you know, graduating from Wheaton and going on to further schooling, we were able to introduce this perspective into our practice, and then into our theorizing on the practice and into missiology.
At the time he started at Fuller, all the students had to have how many years of practical experience?
Yeah, at least three.
Yeah, and so they were all experienced missionaries, and so they were able to take things we were teaching and apply them to where they were and the kind of issues that they had faced.
Yeah. So I'm curious, for you, perhaps there was even a conversation that you had with your husband, a point at which you're like, I remember that conversation, that was a significant shift even for me. Is there anything that stands out like that for you personally? Over the years, you guys talking missiology at home over dinner perhaps, or?
I think often we discuss issues, you know, but I don't remember any one particular time that has happened, so I'm sorry about that.
No, yeah. That's okay. If you think of one, let me know.
We didn't think theoretically at all. We were dealing with practical problems and trying to put them into to help us and others to do what they needed to do.
I've been impressed all along with when we face opposition, my husband's able to prepare things Bible-based and present them in order to explain, like when the field committee all made up of all foreigners on the mission field when we were there, they were all non-Nigerians, and when they called us on the using so much of the culture in our church, and particularly on polygamy, they didn't like the dance either, because they had told them the dance was evil. But God can use the dance, right? You know, we found. And they weren't experimenting, they were just teaching that you don't go to the local dances. But that's probably because there were bad influences there, you know? And so to have a Christian where it's promoting the faith, the dance was something they hadn't really dealt with. But anyhow, Chuck would always write a paper, present it, and very faithfully and quietly show where we were coming from. And I really, really appreciated that. And the same thing when he met opposition with his moving into spiritual power. He was able to prepare, I think God really helped him to prepare the basis and the reason that it works, you know. And so that's been very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the primary concepts anthropologically is forms versus meanings. And so much of what we've done as missionaries is to focus on the forms. And quite often the meanings are different for the people that are...
For instance, our men thought God didn't care for them and didn't even want to break up their families, the polygamists, right? That's what it came across to them, was that God disapproved of them. And that's not true. God loved them as much as anybody else. And he even worked with polygamists in the Old Testament, you know. So it was just really a offbeat rule that most missionaries carried to Africa, because polygamy is very common in Africa.
One day a Nigerian fellow came to me. He was one of our church planters. Well, actually, he was not. They wouldn't let him be a church planter. But he said, I'm going to divorce my second wife. I said, why? He said, because I want to be baptized. I want to be a member of the church. And he was a guy that was so committed to Christ. He built the church building. Paid for it himself. And I said, well, why would you divorce your wife? He said, I've got to be a member of the church. Because he was prohibited from being a member of the church that he built. His name was Derby, and I said, Derby, God's accepted me with a heart full of pride. Do you think he'll reject you simply because you're following your custom and marrying a second wife? Well, the answer was fairly obvious, I think. And the church was on the mission sponsored church was on the wrong side of that issue, but it was keeping this guy was a genuine leader and a committed to Christ in spite of the roadblocks. So, like Meg said, when they had a baptismal ceremony, I was baptizing people. I was baptizing 150 people at a time. They were coming. I mean, it was a very receptive area. And I baptized, and I said to the group, "You all know that there's one person here that the mission will not allow to be baptized, but really belongs with this group to be dedicated." So I said, "Derby, come over and join this group." That's the closest I came to baptizing a polygamist. If I'd known that we were going to be kicked out the mission, I would have done it. I would have broken the rule. I wish I had. What was it, 14 years after we left the field, they changed the rule.
So we figured we were the scapegoats, huh? We tried to help the people realize that scriptures are what we follow and not Western culture, right?
We went back.
But it's sometimes so hard to separate the two in our minds. Don't you think that's true?
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. See, the crucial thing is the meanings. The forms are a manifestation of the meanings, and we should have been about meanings, and when very often we were about forms.
That was a distinction Dr. Nida made too, wasn't it? That was something that we really had sharpened in our thinking through Eugene Nida's writings and teaching. We were happy to be able to sit under his teaching when we were teaching other missionaries or studying even to go to the mission field. We met him. We were at Wycliffe Summer Institute of Linguistics, and he was involved in the teaching there one summer, and we became friends, real good friends with Dr. Nida.
Mm-hmm. As you think back on your formation as teachers of missiology, as missiologists, I want to ask you about God's agency in your life. Can you describe a time that you recognized that God was shaping you? You recognized God's presence, God was there, moving, shaping you as a missiologist. Tell us how this happened.
I'd say it kind of snuck up on us. We never, like I said, we never intended to be professors or teaching on stuff. But as things went by, we weren't allowed to go back to Nigeria by the mission, so we had to find another career. I'm finishing up my autobiography, and I call it Four Careers. And fortunately, I had developed a proficiency in the Hausa language, and so I was hired by Michigan State University to teach Hausa and African languages in general. And that felt like we were being exiled, but it gave us a way to continue, and so we would teach in a secular setting, but invite missionary candidates and so on, and we actually got to train our successor.
You asked for a specific situation. I think there was one time that I realized it was God showing me the right thing when we were on the mission field, and making it very clear in my mind the difference. We had our third child in Nigeria while we were in Nigeria, and so I had a very young baby. I watched a Nigerian woman bathe her baby, and she would take the water and put it in her mouth and hold it there and warm it, and then spit it on the baby and wash the baby after the water had been in her mouth. And my response inside was yuck, you know. I mean, what a terrible way to bathe a new baby, you know. And then I seemed to all of a sudden realize God doesn't care. That's minor, you know. She's important in His eyes, just as important as I am. But I use soap and towel and heat the water and everything. And then I realized it's probably a way out of her range to even think of, you know, having to heat special water and have towel and all this kind of stuff, because they just, their finances, they, that wasn't in their culture. So, but that was a awakening, I think, that kind of really moved me to realize that I still had a long ways to go to get where I could understand and learn. And not that I'm going to change my way right away. I did try to dress simpler, you know, to match the local people, but I didn't bathe my baby that way. But anyhow, I felt like it, my first feeling was she's inferior. She just doesn't know about, you know, keeping things hygiene. Clean and, yeah, hygiene and all. And then so
we're thinking about
all
germs.
Of a sudden, what?
We're thinking about germs.
Yeah, we think about germs. And we think our way is, you know, right to
but most
to
of those
keep,
babies make
yeah.
it.
Yeah, so that was an illustration that came to my That's mind.
As you think about your contributions to missiology as a field of study, what would you say are the most valuable ways that you contribute to this ongoing conversation that is missiology, whether it's in theory or in practices, in practice? What experiences would you say gave rise to these conceptual developments for you? So what are those concepts that have been significant contributions that you've made to missiology? And then where do those come from? Try to trace them for us, if you could.
Well, here's when we came to Fuller, there was an opportunity now to influence field missionaries, because our students all had to have had field experience, 3 years of field experience before they'd be admitted. And we were able to discuss with them and make, I think, important points, changes that should be made in on the field, mistakes that we and others had made. In this discussion we're having now, we're ignoring the fact that we made some mistakes. We did. One time we had a appointing somebody for a position in the church or something like that, and I made a mistake, and I admitted it. And this embarrassed the Nigerians that were there very badly. And then I stood up and apologized. And they said, "We've never heard a missionary apologize. We know you guys make mistakes, but to hear you apologize, it's incredible." I said, "Well, okay, that's what you're supposed to do when you make a mistake." And so to bring these perspectives, what do things mean in their culture? That's the only way of life that they've ever known, and they interpret life coming from where they're coming from, and that may be quite a different place than we're coming from. So the chance to have experienced missionaries in class and to discuss and hopefully help them to do better, and we got reports back from people that had studied here and then gone back to the field of how the mission had changed, and that's something to be treasured. That's a very valuable thing to see people make some of those changes, and hopefully they're better missionaries.
I'm curious if you can remember any specific changes that people wrote back, or they came back and they said, "I've changed this after your class, after learning from you. I went back to China, India, wherever it was, and I changed this or I changed that." Well, can you think of any specific instances?
Well, I think more generally, I was just reading a comment, I think, in this book that's got student comments in the back there, and the Larry Caldwell, one of our former students, he said this just hit him like a ton of bricks. He said he was a different person, different missionary after that. Mm. It's my concept of missiology is incarnational. And we were trying to teach people to be like Jesus, to work as what now they call insiders, work from inside the culture rather than imposing from outside.
Yeah.
And that's just a diagram that I think was relevant for looking at how we do things. And that, you know, that question that people ask, what would Jesus do, was constantly before us. If, you know, in the polygamy issue, would Jesus have turned away from, would he have denied position to people with faith just because we can assert that polygamy is not God's ideal, but that he accepts people as people on the basis of faith alone.
And one of the things I tried in my practice of missiology that I feel was helpful on the bigger scale too is to bring the practical aspect in, because you can read books and it doesn't change your life as much. But when I taught women in missions, I made each of those women find somebody that was from another culture. And then I provided lists of, they needed to see them 6 times, I think, in the course of the semester. And they should meet them for coffee or go to their house or eat a meal at the dining room if they had somebody that was international that was brought up in Africa or somewhere they could get in touch with. And so they had to go check these lists of questions, and they were to ask about that person's life, you know, who was in control at your home, what was the mother expected to do, the father, who held the authority, what kind of family special, what kind of things were special in the family, and then in the community, who were the leaders, what does it mean to be a leader in your community, and in their faith, where do they get spiritual help, you know, what kind of faith, and not to be critical about anything, but just learn to listen, to learn to appreciate somebody else, because so often that's missing from us Americans, right? They need to be like us. We don't so much care about where they're coming from. And so they had to each find a partner, and that partner had to agree that they would meet with them. I gave them a different sheet about different phases of life to go through with this person. At the end of the semester, a gal from El Salvador came up to me and she said, so-and-so chose me for a partner, and I met with her regularly. She says, when I came as a 12-year-old from El Salvador, my folks settled in Palm Springs. I don't know how they got there, but she said, my whole experience has been being shunned by society. She said, the only people who were friends in the classroom were those other internationals, people who had been born elsewhere that I had to hang around with, because nobody else wanted anything to do with me. She says, I even came to Biola, and I find that it was hard because nobody seemed to, you know, really want to be my friend. But she said, this gal that interviewed me, she says, I right away realized how important our friendship was. Mm-hmm. And so it said to me, I'm onto something that would be helpful to us, don't you think? Mm-hmm. If you recognize somebody's happy about telling about their past, they're not ashamed of their past. Mm-hmm. And it can enrich us to know how they grew up, you know, and where they're coming from. And eventually, if it's a matter of trying to be a witness, it can help you be a witness too, because you know where they are. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, that was very satisfying. When I taught language learning, I put them in homes, in Arabic-speaking homes, Spanish-speaking homes, Japanese-speaking homes, and they had to be there day and night. And then I met them each day for class, and they had to go use the lines they were learning, and they were learning culture and language. And one time somebody came and said, there are roaches in this house, and it's cold there, and you know, all the adjustments they were making. Yeah. I said, that's the way it is sometimes when you're in a different culture, you're uncomfortable. And so you have to be willing to be uncomfortable if you want to really get to know somebody and have any kind of a good communication with them. And so I felt like I was teaching important values. And years later, I've run into some of my students from various places we've been, and they said they remember that class, because that class really taught them a life, it kind of changed their lives and helped them be open to differences and not to try to make the rest of the world like them and expect the rest of the world to be like them. So I think, and I taught women in Islam, and I had them go talk with some women on their way into the mosque or whatever, you know, in the communities where they lived, go to grocery stores, and you can usually spot them because they're dressed different. And so they were able to interact with them, and I brought Muslim woman or two to class to answer our questions and talk to us. And I guess I feel that so often we miss a lot of value that other cultures have, that we have ways that, you know, we sometimes often treat people like numbers in our family, you know, gets our spare time and whatnot. And so you, there are a lot of values that you can appreciate in others if you're looking for it. So I felt like adding a practical aspect to my students and helping them experience, not just get head knowledge, but have some experience, was very helpful.
It's a great example.
Here's one of our students that had been he was a missionary before, and he came and took courses. He said, where to start on this now? He says, Chuck Craft, my PhD advisor, opened my eyes wide to the then relatively new discipline, ethnotheology. I took his class on the topic in 1981, and my life has literally not been the same since. I remember hanging on every word and devouring his book, Christianity and Culture. His views have had a deep impact on my own understanding of ethnohermeneutics, a course that I have taught and interpreting the Bible cross-culturally. So that's one of the trophies.
I love that.
And I get emotional talking about these things because I never planned them. Mm. You know, who am I to be looked up to or put in faculty positions or write books or whatever? But God did it. We get bounced out of one situation right into another one, and they had a party for me when I retired, and our families were invited, and one of our grandkids, he was about 12, I guess, on the way home from that party, he asked his parents, he said, is Daddy famous?
Is Grandpa famous?
You know, I look at those things from time to time, and I say, "Is that me? I don't recognize that guy." But it's been a really fun ride. We've gotten to do and be much more than we ever thought we would be. And I covered for everybody that kind of a situation, even if you have to get fired to bring it about.
So my last question is to make three wishes for the future of missiology. What are your hopes for the field? If you had to describe or if you got a chance to shape missiology over the next decade or two, what would be your hopes for the next couple of decades in the field of missiology?
Well, I brought two of my books along because in them there's a section on, you know, what do I want for, what would I like for the future of missiology, and that's your question.
Okay, so you're holding Paradigm Shifts. Yeah. For podcast listeners, this is Paradigm Shifts and Christian Witness.
Yeah.
And Charles Craft, the SWMSIS at 40, a participant observer's view of our history, with a foreword by Doug McConnell.
And in each of them, I've tried to answer this question, what would I like to change? The first one, bar none, would be this: the really getting serious about the power dimension. My next book, I expect to be called Missiology with Power. Mm. See, we went to the field with the best training that was available, especially cultural studies and such. That's what was available, but there was no power, no teaching on power. The Nigerian leaders, I asked them, what's your biggest problem? And without hesitation, they said, demons, spiritual stuff. And I was their missionary. I didn't know how to help them in this area because none of my courses in college, seminary, anything dealt with spiritual power, except as, you know, peripherally, you know, these people are idol worshippers or whatever kind of thing. And that's why, you know, some people are, they think I've gone off the deep end, and I have. I mean to. because that's the end that hasn't been taken care of. And I don't want any of my students to go away without dealing with spiritual power. You can get. So, what would I recommend? Right now, Jay Mueller is teaching the spiritual power course, and that's good. I just hope they don't stop it. At one point, before Wagner left, we had four or five courses dealing with one or another aspect of spiritual power. Mm-hmm. Then he left, and I was the main proponent. So that's that. The second thing, I think, I'm not intimately involved in Fuller now, so I could be mistaken, but I think they've let anthropology and communication slack. Dan Shaw represents the anthropology, but I think there's not a whole lot of emphasis on the cultural thing. And Roberta King has got communication stuff, but she's alone also. So beefing that up would be a very important thing. Third thing, if you take care of those first two, I'm not worried about a third.
And maybe since more of the people now at the School of Interculture Studies haven't had cross-cultural experience,
yeah,
there should be something requiring them to do so in order to put to use all the training they're getting. When I was at Biola in the undergraduate program, in order to get a degree in intercultural studies, you had to go spend at least 3 months in a cross-cultural situation. Now, you could go to the Indian reservation, you could go live in a Muslim community in this country, or you could go to Africa or wherever, but you had to get out of your typical culture and get where you trust God and you go as a learner, you know, and try to really sharpen your skills in a practical way with all the training that you've had. And it seems to me that even if Fuller's got that kind of people there, maybe they need to get some experience to go with. And maybe you have to force that, you know, because a lot of people are there just for a degree. And I think the practical side of learning by doing is important.
Absolutely.
Now, I think maybe when Betty Sue Brewster was teaching language learning, she had them in the community, but not living in the community. Mm-hmm. And that's okay to have to go mix, but there's something in 24/7 being there that you learn some things you don't otherwise. You know, you learn what their attitudes toward outsiders are. You learn how they treat the insiders. I know I took my Peoples of Ethnic America class, had to go stay with black families for the weekend from Thursday through Sunday.
Sometimes sleeping on the springs because they didn't have a mattress.
I would do so too. And so I spent some weekends with various black families. And that I learned so much, you know, even the way they use the telephone to be in touch with each other, you know. I'm too busy to do that. You know, I've got too many things that I'm doing that I don't spend a lot of time unless I've got business to talk to somebody on the telephone. But the socializing, that's important, you know. And if you're trying to reach out to people in a culture like that, you need to be relaxed and spend more time on the phone, you know, or just hanging out doing nothing. Just being together is more important
texting
in a lot of societies. And so it seems to me that maybe there should be some more practical requirement that goes with a degree in intercultural studies and missiology.
We haven't mentioned the Holy Spirit very much. He's always been there in the background and working with us to do wonderful things. So we would certainly thank him big time for what he's done in our lives and what he can do in any life, anybody that lets him.
Excellent. Chuck, Meg, Dr. Scraft, I want to thank you on behalf of Missiology Podcast. Thank you on behalf of all of our listeners. I want to thank you both personally for being a part of that journey, for being a part of what God was doing in bringing missiology to where it is today.
Do you have a product or service, maybe a book that you think our listeners would be interested in? Contact us. We'd love to advertise your stuff. Send an email to podcast@missiology.com to get the ball rolling. Let us help you, help them find your goods. That's podcast@missiology.com.